This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Teacher Man, a Memoir by Frank McCourt. Read by the author.
Prologue. If I knew anything about Sigmund Freud and psychoanalysis, I'd be able to trace all my troubles to my miserable childhood in Ireland. That miserable childhood deprived me of self-esteem, triggered spasms of self-pity, paralyzed my emotions, made me cranky and envious and disrespectful of authority, retarded my development, crippled my doings with the opposite sex, kept me from rising in the world and made me unfit, almost, for human society. How I became a teacher at all and remain one is a miracle, and I have to give myself full marks for surviving all those years in the classrooms of New York. There should be a medal for people who survive miserable childhoods and become teachers, and I should be the first in line for the medal, or whatever bars might be appended for ensuing miseries. I could lay blame. The miserable childhood doesn't simply happen. It is brought about. There are dark forces. If I am to lay blame, it is in a spirit of forgiveness. Therefore, I forgive the following. Pope Pius XII, the English in general, and King George VI in particular. Cardinal McRory, who ruled Ireland when I was a child. The Bishop of Limerick, who seemed to think everything was sinful. Eamon de Valera, former Prime Minister, Taoiseach, and President of Ireland. Mr. de Valera was a half-Spanish Gaelic fanatic, Spanish onion in an Irish stew, who directed teachers all over Ireland to beat the native tongue into us and natural curiosity out of us. He caused us hours of misery. He was aloof and indifferent to the black and blue welts raised by schoolmaster sticks on various parts of our young bodies. I forgive also the priest who drove me from the confessional when I admitted to sins of self-abuse and self-pollution and penny thieveries from my mother's purse. He said I did not show a proper spirit of repentance, especially in the matters of the flesh. And even though he hit that nail right on the head, his refusal to grant me absolution put my soul in such peril that if I'd been flattened by a truck outside the church, he would have been responsible for my eternal damnation. I forgive various bullying schoolmasters for pulling me out of my seat by the sideburns, for walloping me regularly with stick, strap, and cane when I stumbled over answers in the catechism or when, in my head, I couldn't divide 937 by 739. I was told by my parents and other adults it was all for my own good. I forgive them for those whopping hypocrisies, and wonder where they are at this moment. Heaven? Hell? Purgatory, if it still exists? I can even forgive myself, though when I look back at various stages of my life, I groan. What an ass. What timidities, what stupidities, what indecisions and flounderings. But then I take another look. I had spent childhood and adolescence examining my conscience and finding myself in a perpetual state of sin. That was the training, the brainwashing, the conditioning, and it discouraged smugness, especially among the sinning class. Now I think it's time to give myself credit for at least one virtue. Doggedness. Not as glamorous as ambition or talent or intellect or charm, but still the one thing that got me through the days and nights. F. Scott Fitzgerald said that in American lives there are no second acts. He simply did not live long enough. And in my case, he was wrong. When I taught in New York City high schools for 30 years, no one but my students paid me a scrap of attention. In the world outside the school, I was invisible. Then I wrote a book about my childhood and became Mick of the moment. I hoped the book would explain family history to McCaw children and grandchildren. I hoped it might sell a few hundred copies, and I might be invited to have discussions with book clubs. Instead, it jumped on the bestseller list and was translated into 30 languages, and I was dazzled. The book was my second act. In the world of books, I'm a late bloomer, a Johnny-come-lately, new kid on the block. My first book, Angela's Ashes, was published in 1996 when I was 66. The second, Tis, in 1999 when I was 69. At that age, it's a wonder I was able to lift the pen at all. New friends of mine, recently acquired because of my ascension to the bestseller list, had published books in their 20s. Striplings. So, what took you so long? I was teaching, that's what took me so long. Not in college or university, where you have all the time in the world for writing and other diversions, but in four different New York City public high schools. I've read novels about the lives of university professors, where they seem to be so busy with adultery and academic infighting, you wonder where they found time to squeeze in a little teaching. When you teach five high school classes a day, 5 days a week, you're not inclined to go home to clear your head and fashion deathless prose. After a day of five classes, your head is filled with the clamor of the classroom. I never expected Angela's Ashes to attract any attention, but when I hit the bestseller list, I became a media darling. I had my picture taken hundreds of times. I was a geriatric novelty with an Irish accent. I was interviewed for dozens of publications. I met governors, mayors, actors. I met the first President Bush and his son, the governor of Texas. I met President Clinton and Hillary Rodham Clinton. I met Gregory Peck. I met the Pope and kissed his ring. Sarah, Duchess of York, interviewed me. She said I was her first Pulitzer Prize winner. I said she was my first Duchess. She said, ooh, and asked the cameraman, did you get that? Did you get that? I was nominated for a Grammy for the spoken word and nearly met Elton John. People looked at me in a different way. They said, oh, you wrote that book. This way, please, Mr. McCord. Or is there anything you'd like? Anything. A woman in a coffee shop squinted and said, I seen you on TV. You must be important. Who are you? Could I have your autograph? I was listened to. I was asked for my opinion on Ireland, conjunctivitis, drinking, teeth, education, religion, adolescent angst, William Butler Yeats, literature in general. What books are you reading this summer? What books have you read this year? Catholicism, writing, hunger. I spoke to gatherings of dentists, lawyers, ophthalmologists, and of course, teachers. I travel the world being Irish, being a teacher, an authority on misery of all kinds, a beacon of hope to senior citizens everywhere who always wanted to tell their stories. They made a movie of Angela's Ashes. No matter what you write in America, there is always talk of the movie. You could write the Manhattan Telephone Directory and they'd say, so, when is the movie? If I hadn't written Angela's Ashes, I would have died begging. Just one more year, God, just one more year, because this book is the one thing I want to do in my life, what's left of it. I never dreamed it would be a bestseller. I hoped it would sit on bookseller shelves while I lurked in the bookshop and watched beautiful women turn pages and shed the occasional tear. They'd buy the book, of course, take it home, loll on divans, and read my story while sipping herbal tea or a fine sherry. They'd order copies for all their friends. In Tis, I wrote about my life in America and how I became a teacher. After it was published, I had the nagging feeling I'd given teaching short shrift. In America, doctors, lawyers, generals, actors, television people, and politicians are admired and rewarded, not teachers. Teaching is the downstairs maid of professions. Teachers are told to use the service door or go round the back. They are congratulated on having ATTO, all that time off. They're spoken of patronizingly and petted retroactively on their silvery locks. Oh, yes. I had an English teacher, Miss Smith, who really inspired me. I'll never forget dear old Miss Smith. She used to say that if she reached one child in her 40 years of teaching, it would make it all worthwhile. She'd die happy. The inspiring English teacher then fades into grey shadows to eke out her days on a penny-pinching pension, dreaming of the one child she might have reached. Dream on, teacher. You will not be celebrated. You think you'll walk into the classroom, stand a moment, wait for silence, watch while they open notebooks and click pens, tell them your name, write it on the board, proceed to teach. On your desk, you have the English course of study provided by the school. You'll teach spelling, vocabulary, grammar, reading comprehension, composition, literature. You can't wait to get to the literature. You'll have lively discussions about poems, plays, essays, novels, short stories. The hands of 170 students will quiver in the air, and they'll call out, "Mr. McCourt, me, I want to say something." You hope they'll want to say something. You don't want them to sit gawking while you struggle to keep a lesson alive. You'll feast on the bodies of English and American literature. What a time you'll have with Carlyle and Arnold, Emerson and Thoreau. You can't wait to get to Shelley, Keats and Byron, and good old Walt Whitman. Your classes will love all that romanticism, rebellion, all that defiance. You'll love it yourself because, deep down and in your dreams, you're a wild romantic. You'll see yourself on the barricades. Principals and other figures of authority passing in the hallways will hear sounds of excitement from your room. They'll peer through the door window in wonder at all the raised hands, the eagerness and excitement on the faces of these boys and girls, these plumbers, electricians, beauticians, carpenters, mechanics, typists, machinists. You'll be nominated for awards, Teacher of the Year, Teacher of the Century. You'll be invited to Washington. Eisenhower will shake your hand. Newspapers will ask you, a mere teacher, for your opinion on education. This would be big news. A teacher asks for his opinion on education. Wow. You'll be on television. Television. Imagine. A teacher on television. They'll fly you to Hollywood, where you'll star in movies about your own life. Humble beginnings, miserable childhood, problems with the church, which you bravely defied. Images of you solitary in the corner, reading by candlelight, Chaucer, Shakespeare, Austin, Dickens. You there in the corner, blinking with your poor diseased eyes, bravely reading till your mother pulls the candle away from you, tells you if you don't stop, the two eyes will fall out of your head entirely. You plead for the candle back. You have only 100 pages left in Dombey and Son, and she says, "No, I don't want to be leading you around Limerick with people asking how you went blind when a year ago you were kicking a ball with the best of them." You say yes to your mother because you know the song. A mother's love is a blessing, no matter where you go. Keep her while you have her, you'll miss her when she's gone. Besides, you could never talk back to a movie mother played by one of those old Irish actresses, Sarah Allgood or Una O'Connor, with their sharp tongues and their suffering faces. Your own mother had a powerful hurt look too, but there's nothing like seeing it on the big screen in black and white or living color. Your father could be played by Clark Gable, except that A, he might not be able to handle your father's North of Ireland accent, and B, it would be a terrible come-down from Gone with the Wind, which, you remember, was banned in Ireland because, it is said, Rhett Butler carried his own wife Scarlett up the stairs and into bed, which upset the film censors in Dublin and caused them to ban the film entirely. No, you'd need someone else as your father because the Irish censors would be watching closely, and you'd be badly disappointed if the people in Limerick, your city, and the rest of Ireland were denied the opportunity of seeing the story of your miserable childhood and subsequent triumph as teacher and movie star. But that would not be the end of the story. The real story would be how you eventually resisted the siren call of Hollywood, how after nights of being dined, wined, fated, and lured to the beds of female stars, established and aspiring, you discovered the hollowness of their lives. How they poured out their hearts to you on various satin pillows, how you listened with twinges of guilt while they expressed their admiration for you, that you, because of your devotion to your students, had become an idol and an icon in Hollywood, how they, the ravishing female stars, established and aspiring, regretted how they had gone astray, embracing the emptiness of their Hollywood lives when, if they give it all up, they could rejoice daily in the integrity of teaching the future craftsmen, tradesmen, and Kirk typists of America. How it must feel, they would say, to wake up in the morning, to leap gladly from the bed, knowing that before you stretch the day in which you do God's work with the youth of America, content with your meager remuneration, your real reward, the glow of gratitude in the eager eyes of your students as they bear gifts from their grateful and admiring parents, cookies, bread, homemade pasta, and the occasional bottle of wine from the backyard vines of Italian families, the mothers and fathers of your 170 students at McKee Vocational and Technical High School, borough of Staten Island, in the city of New York. Part 1. It's a long road to pedagogy. Here they come. And I'm not ready. How could I be? I'm a new teacher and learning on the job. On the first day of my teaching career, I was almost fired for eating the sandwich of a high school boy. On the second day, I was almost fired for mentioning the possibility of friendship with a sheep. Otherwise, there was nothing remarkable about my 30 years in the high school classrooms of New York City. I often doubted if I should be there at all. At the end, I wondered how I lasted that long. It is March 1958. I sit at my desk in an empty classroom in McKee Vocational and Technical High School in the borough of Staten Island, New York City. I toy with the implements of my new calling. 5 manila folders, one for each class, a clump of crumbling rubber bands, a block of brown wartime composition paper flecked with whatever went into the making of it, a worn blackboard eraser, a stack of white cards that I will insert row by row into slots in this tattered red Delaney book to help me remember the names of 170 boys and girls who would sit in rows every day in 5 different classes. On the cards, I'll record their attendance and tardiness and make little marks when boys and girls do bad things. I'm told I should keep a red pen to record the bad things, but the school hasn't supplied one, and now I have to request it on a form or buy one in a shop because the red pen for the bad things is the teacher's most powerful weapon. There are many things I would have to buy in a shop. In Eisenhower's America, there's prosperity, but it does not trickle down to schools, especially to new teachers who need supplies for their classes. There's a note from an assistant principal in charge of administration reminding all teachers of the city's financial plight and to please use these supplies sparingly. This morning I have to make decisions. In a minute the bell will ring, they'll swarm in, and what will they say if they see me at the desk? Hey, look, he's hiding out. They're experts on teachers. Sitting at the desk means you're scared or lazy. You're using the desk as a barrier. Best thing is to get out there and stand. Face the music. Be a man. Make one mistake your first day, and it takes months to recover. The kids arriving are juniors, 16 years old, 11 years in school from kindergarten to today. So, teachers come, teachers go, all kinds, old, young, tough, kind. Kids watch, scrutinize, judge. They know body language, tone of voice, demeanor in general. It's not as if they sit around the toilets or cafeterias discussing these things. They just absorb it over 11 years, pass it on to coming generations. Watch out for Miss Boyd, they'll say. Homework, man, homework, and she corrects it. She ain't married, so she's got nothing else to do. Always try to get married teachers with kids. They don't have time for sitting around with papers and books. If Miss Boyd got laid regular, she wouldn't give so much homework. She sits there at home with her cat, listening to classical music, correcting her homework, bothering us. Not like some teachers. They give you a pile of homework, check it off, never even look at it. You could copy a page of the Bible and then write at the top.
Very nice.
Not Miss Boyd. She's on to you right off. Excuse me, Charlie, did you write this yourself? And you have to admit, no, you didn't, and now you're up Shit Creek, man. It's a mistake to arrive early. Gives you too much time to think of what you're facing. Where did I get the nerve to think I could handle American teenagers? Ignorance. That's where I got the nerve. It is the Eisenhower era, and newspapers report the great unhappiness of American adolescents. These are the lost children of the lost children of the lost generation. Movies, musicals, books tell us of their unhappiness. Rebel Without a Cause, The Blackboard Jungle, West Side Story, The Catcher in the Rye. They make despairing speeches. Life is meaningless. All adults are phonies. What's the use of living at all? They have nothing to look forward to, not even a war of their own, where they can kill natives in distant places and march up ticker-tape Broadway with medals and limps for the girls to admire. No use complaining to their fathers who just fought a war, or their mothers who waited while the fathers fought. Fathers say, "Ah, shut up, don't bother me. I got a pound of shrapnel up my ass, and I don't have time for you bitching and moaning with your belly full and your closet stuffed with clothes. For Christ's sakes, when I was your age, I was out working in a junkyard before I went in the docks so I could send your sorry ass to school. So go squeeze your goddamn pimples and let me read my paper." There's so much teen unhappiness. They form gangs and fight other gangs. Not rumbles like the ones you see in movies with star-crossed romances and dramatic music in the background, but mean fights, where they grunt and curse one another, where Italians, blacks, Irish, Puerto Ricans attack with knives, chains, baseball bats in Central Park and Prospect Park, and stain the grass with their blood, which is always red, no matter where it came from. Then if there's a killing, there's public outrage and accusations that if the schools and teachers were doing their job, these terrible things wouldn't happen. There are patriots who say, "If these kids have the time and energy to be fighting one another, why can't we just ship them overseas to fight the goddamn communists and settle that problem for once and for all?" Vocational schools were seen by many as dumping grounds for students ill-equipped for academic high schools. That was snobbery. Didn't matter to the public that thousands of young people wanted to be auto mechanics, beauticians, machinists, electricians, plumbers, carpenters. They didn't want to be bothered with the Reformation, the War of 1812, Walt Whitman, art appreciation, the sex life of the fruit fly. But man, if we have to do it, we'll do it. We'll sit in those classes that have nothing to do with our lives. We'll work in our shops where we learn about the real world, and we'll try to be nice to the teachers and get out of here in 4 years. Phew. Here they are. The door slams against the shelf that runs along the base of the blackboard, stirs a cloud of chalk dust. Entering a room is the big deal. Why couldn't they simply walk into the room, say, "Good morning," and sit? Oh, no, they have to push and jostle. One says, "Hey," in a mock threatening way, and another one says, "Hey," right back. They insult one another, ignore the late bell, take the time sitting. That's cool, baby. Look, there's a new teacher up there. New teachers don't know shit. So, bell, teacher, new guy. Who is he? Who cares? They talk to friends across the room, lounge in desks too small for them, stick out their legs, laugh if someone trips. They stare out the window, over my head, at the American flag, or the pictures taped to the walls by Ms. Mudd, now retired. Pictures of Emerson, Thoreau, Whitman, Emily Dickinson, and how did he get here? Ernest Hemingway. It's a Life magazine cover, and that picture is everywhere. They gouge their initials on desktops with penknives, declarations of love with hearts and arrows alongside the long-ago gougings of their fathers and brothers. Some old desks are gouged so deep you can see your knees through holes where hearts and names used to be. Couples sit together, hold hands, whisper, and gaze into each other's eyes while three boys against the back closet sing doo-wop, bass, baritone, and high notes. Man, snap fingers, tell the world they're just teenagers in love. 5 times a day they push into the room. 5 classes, 30 to 35 in each class. Teenagers? In Ireland we saw them in American movies, moody, surly, driving around in cars, and we wondered why they were moody and surly. They had food and clothes and money, and still they were mean to their parents. There were no teenagers in Ireland, not in my world. You were a child. You went to school till you were 14. If you were mean to your parents, they'd give you a good belt in the gob and send you flying across the room. You grew up, got a labouring job, got married, drank your pint on a Friday night, jumped on the wife that same night and kept her pregnant forever. In a few years you emigrated to England to work on the building sites, or to enlist in His Majesty's forces and fight for the Empire. The problem of the sandwich started when a boy named Petey called out, "Anybody want a bologna sandwich?" "You kidding? Your mamas hate you giving you sandwiches like that." Petey threw his brown paper sandwich back at the critic, Andy, and the class cheered. "Fight, fight," they said. "Fight, fight." The bag landed on the floor between the blackboard and Andy's front row desk. I came from behind my desk and made the first sound of my teaching career. "Hey!" 4 years of higher education at New York University, and all I could think of was, "Hey!" I said it again. "Hey!" They ignored me. They were busy promoting the fight that would kill time and divert me from any lesson I might be planning. I moved toward Petey and made my first teacher statement. "Stop throwing sandwiches!" Petey and the class looked startled. This teacher, new teacher, just stopped a good fight. New teachers are supposed to mind their own business or sent for the principal or a dean, and everyone knows it's years before they come, which means you can have a good fight while waiting. Besides, what are you going to do with a teacher who tells you stop throwing sandwiches when you already threw the sandwich? Benny called out from the back of the room, "Hey, teach, he already threw the sandwich. No use telling him now, don't throw the sandwich. There is the sandwich there on the floor." The class laughed. There's nothing sillier in the world than a teacher telling you don't do it after you already did it. One boy covered his mouth and said, "Stupid," and I knew he was referring to me. I wanted to knock him out of his seat, but that would have been the end of my teaching career. Besides, the hand that covered his mouth was huge, and his desk was too small for his body. Someone said, "Yo, Benny, you a lawyer, man?" And the class laughed again. "Yeah, yeah," they said, and waited for my move. What will this new teacher do? Professors of education at New York University never lectured on how to handle flying sandwich situations. They talked about theories and philosophies of education, about moral and ethical imperatives, about the necessity of dealing with the whole child, the gestalt, if you don't mind, the child's felt needs, but never about critical moments in the classroom. Should I say, "Hey, Petey, get up here and pick up that sandwich," or else? Should I pick it up myself and throw it into the waste paper basket to show my contempt for people who throw sandwiches while millions starve all over the world? They had to recognize I was boss, that I was tough, that I'd take none of their shit. The sandwich, in wax paper, lay halfway out of the bag, and the aroma told me there was more to this than bologna. I picked it up and slid it from its wrapping. It was not any ordinary sandwich where meat is slapped between slices of tasteless white American bread. This bread was dark and thick, baked by an Italian mother in Brooklyn. Bread firm enough to hold slices of a rich bologna, layered with slices of tomato, onions and peppers, drizzled with olive oil, and charged with a tongue-dazzling relish. I ate the sandwich. It was my first act of classroom management. My mouth clogged with sandwich attracted the attention of the class. They gawked up at me. 34 boys and girls, average age 16. I could see the admiration in their eyes. First teacher in their lives to pick up a sandwich from the floor and eat it in full view. Sandwich man. In my boyhood in Ireland, we admired one schoolmaster who peeled and ate an apple every day and rewarded good boys with a long peel. These kids watched the oil dribble down my chin to my $2 tie from Klein on the square. Petey said, "Yo, teacher, that's my sandwich you ate." Class told him, "Shut up. Can't you see the teacher's eating?" I licked my fingers. I said, "Yum," made a ball of paper bag and wax paper, and flipped it into the trash basket. The class cheered. "Wow," they said. "And yo, baby, a man, look at that. He eats the sandwich. He hits the basket. Wow." So this is teaching. Yeah, wow. I felt like a champion. I ate the sandwich. I hit the basket. I felt I could do anything with this class. I thought I had them in the palm of my hand. Fine, except I didn't know what to do next. I was there to teach and wondered how I should move from a sandwich situation to spelling or grammar or the structure of a paragraph or anything related to the subject I was supposed to teach, English. My students smiled till they saw the principal's face framed in the door window. Bushy black eyebrows halfway up his forehead shaped a question. He opened the door and beckoned me out. "A word, Mr. McCourt?" Petey whispered, "Hey, mister, don't worry about the sandwich. I didn't want it anyway." The class said, "Yeah, yeah," in a way that showed they were on my side if I had trouble with the principal. My first experience of teacher-student solidarity. In the classroom, your students might stall and complain, but when a principal or any other outsider appeared, there was immediate unity, a solid front. Out in the hallway, he said, "I'm sure you understand, Mr. McCourt, it isn't seemly to have teachers eating their lunch at 9 a.m. in their classrooms in the presence of these boys and girls. Your first teacher experience, and you choose to begin it by eating a sandwich? Is that proper procedure, young man? It's not our practice here. It gives children the wrong idea. You can see the reasoning, eh? Think of the problems we'd have if teachers just dropped everything and began to eat their lunches in class, especially in the morning when it's still breakfast time. We have enough trouble with kids sneaking little nibbles during morning classes and attracting cockroaches and various rodents. Squirrels have been chased from these rooms, and I won't even mention rats. If we're not vigilant, these kids and some teachers, your colleagues, young man, will turn the school into one big cafeteria." I wanted to tell him the truth about the sandwich and how well I handled the situation, but if I did, it might be the end of my teaching job. I wanted to say, "Sir, it was not my lunch. That was the sandwich of a boy who threw it at another boy, and I picked it up because I'm new here. And this thing happened in my class, and there was nothing in the courses at college on sandwiches, the throwing and retrieving of. I know I ate the sandwich, but I did it out of desperation, or I did it to teach the class a lesson about waste and to show them who was in charge, or Jesus, I ate it because I was hungry, and I promised never to do it again for fear I might lose my good job, though you must admit the class was quiet. If that's the way to capture the attention of kids in a vocational high school, you ought to send out for a pile of bologna sandwiches for the four classes I still have to meet today." I said nothing. The principal said he was there to help me because, ha-ha, I look like I might need a lot of help. "I'll admit," he said, "you have their full attention. Okay, but see if you can do it in a less dramatic way. Try teaching. That's what you're here for, young man, teaching. Now you have ground to recover, that's all. No eating in class for teacher or student." I said, "Yes, sir," and he waved me back to the classroom. The class said, "What did he say?" "He said I shouldn't eat my lunch in the classroom at 9 a.m. "You wasn't eating no lunch." "I know, but he saw me with the sandwich and told me not to do it again." "Man, that's unfair." Petey said, "I'll tell my mom you liked her sandwich. I'll tell her you got in a lot of trouble over her sandwich." "All right, Petey, but don't tell her you threw it away." Nah, she'd kill me. She's from Sicily. They get excited over there in Sicily." "Tell her it was the most delicious sandwich I ever had in my life, Petey." "Okay." Mea culpa. Instead of teaching, I told stories. Anything to keep them quiet and in their seats. They thought I was teaching. I thought I was teaching. I was learning. "And you called yourself a teacher?" "I didn't call myself anything. I was more than a teacher, and less. In the high school classroom, you're a drill sergeant, a rabbi, a shoulder to cry on, a disciplinarian, a singer, a low-level scholar, a clerk, a referee, a clown, a counselor, a dress code enforcer, a conductor, an apologist, a philosopher, a collaborator, a tap dancer, a politician, a therapist, a fool, a traffic cop, a priest, a mother, father, brother, sister, uncle, aunt, a bookkeeper, a critic, a psychologist, the last straw. In the teacher's cafeteria, veterans warn me, son, tell them nothing about yourself. They're kids, goddammit. You're the teacher. You have a right to privacy. You know the game, don't you? The little buggers are diabolical. They're not, repeat, not your natural friends. They can smell it when you're going to teach a real lesson on grammar or something, and they'll head you off at the pass, baby. Watch 'em. Those kids have been at this for years, 11 or 12, and they have teachers all figured out. They'll know if you're even thinking about grammar or spelling. And they'll raise their little hands and put on that interested expression and ask you what games you played as a kid or who do you like for the goddamn World Series. Oh, yeah. And you'll fall for it. Next thing is you're spilling your guts and they go home not knowing one end of a sentence from the other but telling the moms and dads about your life. Not that they care. They'll get by. But where does that leave you? You can never get back the bits and pieces of your life that stick in their little heads. Your life, man, it's all you have. Tell them nothing. The advice was wasted. I learned through trial and error and paid a price for it. I had to find my own way of being a man and a teacher. And that is what I struggled with for 30 years in and out of the classrooms of New York. My students didn't know there was a man up there escaping a cocoon of Irish history and Catholicism, leaving bits of that cocoon everywhere. My life saved my life. On my second day at McKee, a boy asks a question that sends me into the past and colors the way I teach for the next 30 years. I'm nudged into the past, the materials of my life. Joey Santa calls out, "Yo, teach!" You are not to call out. You are to raise your hand. "Yeah, yeah," said Joy. "But..." They have a way of saying "yeah, yeah" that tells you they're barely tolerating you. In the "yeah, yeah," they're saying, "We're trying to be patient, man, giving you a break because you're just a new teacher." Joy raises his hand. "Yo, teacher, man." "Call me Mr. McCord." "Yeah, okay, so, you Scotch or something?" Joy is the mouth. There's one in every class, along with the complainer, the clown, the goody-goody, the beauty queen, the volunteer for everything, the jock, the intellectual, the mama's boy, the mystic, the sissy, the lover, the critic, the jerk, the religious fanatic who sees sin everywhere, the brooding one who sits in the back staring at the desk, the happy one, the saint who finds good in all creatures. It's the job of the mouth to ask questions, anything to keep the teacher from the boring lesson. I may be a new teacher, but I'm on to Joy's delaying game. It's universal. I played the same game in Ireland. I was the mouth in my class in Leamy's National School. The master would write an algebra question or an Irish conjugation on the board, and the boys would hiss, "Ask him a question, McCord. Get him away from the bloody lesson. Go on, go on." I'd say, "Sir, did they have algebra in olden times in Ireland?" Mr. O'Halloran liked me, good boy, neat handwriting, always polite and obedient. He would put the chalk down, and from the way he sat at his desk and took his time before speaking, you could see how happy he was to escape from algebra and Irish syntax. He'd say, "Boys, you have every right to be proud of your ancestors. Long before the Greeks, even the Egyptians, your forefathers in this lovely land could capture the rays of the sun in the heart of winter and direct them to dark inner chambers for a few golden moments. They knew the ways of the heavenly bodies, and that took them beyond algebra, beyond calculus, beyond, boys, oh, beyond, beyond." Sometimes in the warm days of the spring, he dozed off in his chair, and we sat quietly, 40 of us, waiting for him to wake, not even daring to leave the room if he slept past going home time. "No, I'm not Scotch, I'm Irish." Joy looks sincere. "Oh yeah, what's Irish?" "Irish is whatever comes out of Ireland. Like St. Patrick, right?
Well, no, not exactly.
This leads to the telling of the story of St. Patrick, which keeps us away from the B-O-R-I-N-G English lesson, which leads to other questions. Hey, mister, everyone talk English over there in Ireland? What kind of sports you play? Y'all Catholics in Ireland?
Don't let them take over the classroom. Stand up to them. Show them who's in charge. Be firm or be dead. Take no shit. Tell them, open your notebooks. Time for the spelling list.
Ah, teacher, ah, God, ah, man, spelling, spelling, spelling. Do we have to?
They moan.
B-O-R-I-N-G, spelling list.
They pretend to bang their foreheads on desks, burying their faces in their folded arms. They beg for the pass.
Gotta go, man, we thought you were a nice guy, young and all. Why do all these English teachers have to do the same old thing, same old spelling lessons, same old vocabulary lessons, same old shit, excuse the language, can't you tell us more about Ireland?
Yo, teacher man. Joy again, mouth to the rescue.
Joy? I told you my name is Mr. McCourt, Mr. McCourt, Mr. McCourt. Yeah, yeah, so mister, do you go out with girls in Ireland?
No, damn it.
Sheep. We went out with sheep. What do you think we went out with?
The class explodes. They laugh, clutch their chest, nudge, elbow one another, pretend to fall out of their desks. This teacher, crazy man, talks funny, goes out with sheep. Lock up your sheep.
Excuse me. Open your notebooks, please. We have a spelling list to cover. Hysterics. Would sheep be on the list? Oh, man.
That smart-ass response was a mistake. There would be trouble. The goody-goody, the saint, and the critic will surely report me.
Oh, Mom, oh, Dad, oh, Mr. Principal, guess what teacher said in class today? Bad things about sheep.
I'm not prepared, trained, or ready for this. It's not teaching. It has nothing to do with English literature, grammar, writing. When will I be strong enough to walk into the room, get their immediate attention, and teach? Around this school, there are quiet, industrious classes where teachers are in command. In the cafeteria, older teachers tell me, yeah, it takes at least 5 years. Next day, the principal sends for me. He sits behind his desk, talking into the telephone, smoking a cigarette. He keeps saying, I'm sorry, it won't happen again. I'll speak to the person involved, new teacher, I'm afraid. He puts the phone down. Sheep? What's this about sheep? Sheep? I don't know what I'm going to do with you. There's a complaint you said, damn it, in class. I know you're just off the boat from an agricultural country and don't know the ropes, but you should have some common sense.
No, sir, not off the boat. I've been here 8.5 years. Including my 2 years in the army, not counting years of infancy in Brooklyn.
Well, look. First the sandwich, now the sheep. Damn phone ringing off the hook, parents up in arms. I have to cover my ass. You're 2 days in the building and 2 days you're in the soup. How do you do it? If you'll excuse the expression, you're inclined to screw up a bit. Why the hell did you have to tell these kids about the sheep?
I'm sorry. They kept asking me questions, and I was exasperated. They were only trying to keep me away from the spelling list.
That's it?
I thought the sheep thing was a bit funny at the time.
Oh, yeah, indeed. You standing there advocating bestiality. 13 parents are demanding you be fired. There are righteous people on Staten Island.
I was only joking.
No, young man. No jokes here. There's a time and place. When you say something in class, they take you seriously. You're the teacher. You say you went out with sheep, and they're going to swallow every word. They don't know about the mating habits of the Irish.
I'm sorry.
All right, this time I'll let it go. I'll tell the parents you're just an Irish immigrant off the boat.
But I was born here.
Could you be quiet for 1 minute and listen while I save your life, huh? This time I'll let it go. I won't put a letter in your file. You don't realize how serious it is to get a letter in your file. If you've got any ambition to rise in the system, principal, assistant principal, guidance counselor, the letter in the file will hold you back. It's the start of the long downward slide.
Sir,
I don't want to be principal. I just want to teach. Yeah, yeah. That's what they all say. You'll get over it. These kids will give you grey hair before you're 30. It was clear I was not cut out to be the purposeful kind of teacher who brushed aside all questions, requests, complaints to get on with the well-planned lesson. That would have reminded me of that school in Limerick where the lesson was king and we were nothing. I was already dreaming of a school where teachers were guides and mentors, not taskmasters. I didn't have any particular philosophy of education except that I was uncomfortable with the bureaucrats, the higher-ups, who had escaped classrooms only to turn and bother the occupants of those classrooms, teachers and students. I never wanted to fill out their forms, follow their guidelines, administer their examinations, tolerate their snooping, adjust myself to their programs and courses of study. If a principal had ever said, "The class is yours, teacher. Do with it what you like," I would have said to my students, "Push the chairs aside. Sit on the floor. Go to sleep." "What?" I said, "Go to sleep." "Why?" "Figure it out for yourself while you're lying there on the floor." They'd lie on the floor and some would drift off. They would be giggling as boy wriggled close to the girl. Sleepers would snore sweetly. I'd stretch out with them on the floor and ask if anyone knew a lullaby. I know a girl would start and others would join. A boy might say, "Man, what if the principal walked in?" "Yeah." The lullaby continues, a murmur around the room. "Mr. McCourt, when are we getting up?" He's told, "Shush, man." And he shushes. The bell rings and they're slow off the floor. They leave the room, relaxed and puzzled. Please don't ask me why I'd have such a session. It must be the spirit that moves. If you were in my classes in the early McKee days, you would have seen a scrawny young man in his late 20s with unruly black hair, eyes that flared with a chronic infection, bad teeth, and the hangdog look you see on immigrants in Ellis Island photographs or on pickpockets being arrested. There were reasons for the hangdog look. I was born in New York and taken to Ireland before I was 4. I had 3 brothers. My father, an alcoholic, wild man, great patriot, ready always to die for Ireland, abandoned us when I was 10, going on 11. A baby sister died, 2 boys died, 2 boys were born. My mother begged for food, clothing, and coal to boil water for the tea. Neighbors told her to place us in an orphanage, me and my brothers. "No, no, never. The shame of it." She hung on. We grew. My brothers and I left school at 14, worked, dreamed of America, and one by one, sailed away. My mother followed with the youngest, expecting to live happily ever after. That's what you're supposed to do in America. But she never had a moment of happy ever after. In New York, I worked at menial and laboring jobs till I was drafted into the United States Army. After 2 years in Germany, I went to college on the GI Bill to become a teacher. In college, there were courses on literature and composition. There were courses on how to teach by professors who did not know how to teach. "So, Mr. McCourt, what was it like growing up in, you know, Ireland?" I'm 27 years old, a new teacher, dipping into my past to satisfy these American teenagers, to keep them quiet and in their seats. I never thought my past would be so useful. Why would anyone want to know about my miserable life? Then I realize this is what my father did when he told the stories by the fire. He told us about men called Shanakis who traveled the country, telling the hundreds of stories they carried in their heads. People would let them warm themselves by the fire, offer them a drop, feed them whatever they were having themselves, listen to hours of story and song that seemed endless, give them a blanket or a sack to cover themselves on the bed of straw in the corner. If the Shanaki needed love, there might be an aging daughter available. I argue with myself. You're telling stories and you're supposed to be teaching. I am teaching. Storytelling is teaching. Storytelling is a waste of time. I can't help it. I'm not good at lecturing. You're a fraud. You're cheating our children. They don't seem to think so. The poor kids don't know. I'm a teacher in an American school, telling stories of my school days in Ireland.
It's a routine that softens them up in the unlikely event that I might teach something solid from the curriculum. One day, my schoolmaster joked that I looked like something the cat brought in. The class laughed. The master smiled with his great yellow horsey teeth and gobs of phlegm stirred and rattled in his gullet. My classmates took that as a laugh, and when they laughed with him, I hated them. I hated the master too, because I knew that for days to come I'd be known in the schoolyard as the one the cat brought in. If the master had made that remark about another boy, I would have laughed too, because I was as great a coward as the next one, terrified of the stick. There was one boy in the class who did not laugh with everyone else, Billy Campbell. When the class laughed, Billy would stare straight ahead, and the master would stare at him, waiting for him to be like everyone else. We waited for him to drag Billy from his seat, but he never did. I think the master admired him for his independence. I admired him too, and wished I had his courage. It never came to me. Boys in that Irish school mocked the American accent I had from New York. You can't go away and leave your accent behind, and when they mock your accent, you don't know what to do or think or feel till the pushing starts, and you know they're trying to get a rise out of you. It's you against 40 boys from the lanes of Limerick, and you can't run, for if you do, you'll be known as a sissy or a Nancy boy the rest of your life. They call you gangster or redskin. Then you fight and fight till someone hits you on the nose and you're pumping blood all over your one shirt, which will get you into terrible trouble with your mother, who will leave her chair by the fire and give you a good clitter on the head for fighting at all. There's no use trying to explain to your mother that you got all this blood from defending your American accent, which you had because of her in the first place. No, she'll say. Now she has to boil water and wash your bloody shirt and see if she can dry it before the fire so you can have it for school tomorrow. She says nothing about the American accent that got you into trouble in the first place, but it's all right, because in a few months that accent will disappear, to be replaced, thank God, with a Limerick accent anyone but my father would be proud of. Because of my father, my troubles were not over. You'd think, with my perfect Limerick accent at the age of 4, the boys would stop tormenting me, but no, they start mimicking my father's North of Ireland accent and saying he's some class of a Protestant, and now I have to defend him. Once more it's home to my mother with the bloody shirt, and my mother yells, if she has to wash this shirt one more time, it will surely fall apart in her hands. The worst part was the time when she couldn't get the shirt dry by morning, and I had to wear it damp to school. When I came home, my nose was stuffed, my whole body shivered with the damp again, this time from sweat. My mother was distracted and cried all over me for being mean to me and sending me to school with that damp shirt that was getting redder and redder from all the fights. She put me to bed and buried me under old overcoats and the blanket from her own bed till the shivering stopped and I drifted off to sleep, listening to her downstairs talking to my father, and saying it was a sad day they left Brooklyn to have the children tormented in the schoolyards of Limerick. After 2 days in bed, I returned to school in the shirt that was now a pale shade of pink. The boys said pink was a colour for sissies and was I a girl. Billy Campbell stood up to the biggest of them. "Leave the Yank alone," he said. "Oh," said the big boy, "who's going to make me?" "I am," said Billy. And the big boy went to the other side of the yard to play. Billy understood my problem because his father was from Dublin, and sometimes the boy sneered even at that. I told stories about Billy because he had the kind of courage I admired. Then one of my McKee students raised his hand and said it was all right to admire Billy, but didn't I stand up to a whole group over my American accent, and shouldn't I admire myself? I said no. I did only what I had to do with everyone in that Irish school, pushing and taunting me, but this 15-year-old McKee boy insisted you have to give yourself credit, not too much because that would be bragging. I said, okay, I'd give myself credit for fighting back, except that I wasn't as brave as Billy, who would fight not for himself but for others. He owed me nothing, but he still defended me, and that was the kind of courage I hoped to have someday. My students ask about my family and bits of my past drift into my head. I realize I'm making discoveries about myself and I tell this story the way my mother told a neighbor. I was pushing the pram with Malachi in it and him a little fella barely too. Frank was walking along beside me. Outside Todd's store on O'Connell Street, a long black motor car pulled up to the pavement and out got this rich woman, all dressed up in furs and jewelry. Well, didn't she look into the pram, and didn't she offer to buy Malachi on the spot? You can imagine what a shock that was to me, a woman wanting to buy Malachi with his golden blonde hair, his pink cheeks, his lovely little pearly white teeth. He was so lovely there in the pram, and I knew parting with him would break my heart. Besides, what would my husband say if I came home and told him I sold the child? So I told the woman no, and she looked so sad my heart went out to her. When I grew older and heard her tell that story for the 100th time, I said she should have sold Malachi and there would have been more food for the rest of us. She said, well, I offered you, but the woman wasn't a bit interested. Girls in the class said, "Ah, gee, Mr. McCore, your mother shouldn't have done that to you. People shouldn't offer to sell their children. You ain't so ugly." Boys in the class said, "Well, he ain't no Clark Gable. Just kidding, Mr. McCourt." Mea culpa. When I was 6, the schoolmaster in Ireland told me I was a bad boy. "You're a very bad boy." He said all the boys in the class were very bad boys. He reminded us that he was using the word "very," a word he would use only on special occasions like this. If we ever used that word answering a question or writing a composition, he'd have our scalps. On this occasion, it was allowed. That's how bad we were. He'd never seen such a collection and wondered what was the use of teaching urchins and armadons. Our heads were filled with American trash from the Lyric Cinema. We were to bow those heads, pound our chests, and say, "Mea culpa, mea culpa. Mea maxima culpa." I thought it meant "I'm sorry," till he wrote on the board, "Mea culpa, I am guilty." He said we were born in original sin, which was supposed to be washed away with the waters of baptism. He said it was clear that rivers of baptismal water had been wasted on the likes of us. One look at our darting little eyes was proof of our wickedness. He was there to prepare us for first confession, first communion, to save our worthless souls. He taught us examination of conscience. We were to look inward, to search the landscape of our souls. We were born with original sin, which was a nasty, oozing thing, marring the dazzling whiteness of our souls. Baptism restored their white perfection. But now, we were older, and there were the sins, sores, gashes, abscesses. We were to drag them wriggling, squirming, putrid into God's glorious light. Examination of conscience, boys, followed by the mea culpa. Powerful laxative, boys, cleans you out better than a dose of salts. Every day, we practiced examination of conscience and confessed our sins to him in the class. The master said nothing, sat at his desk, nodded, fondled the slim stick he used to keep us in a state of grace. We confessed to all the 7 deadly sins: pride, covetousness, lust, anger, gluttony, envy, sloth. He would point the stick and say, "Madigan, confess to us how you committed the deadly sin, envy." Our favorite deadly sin for confessing was gluttony, and when he pointed the stick at Paddy Clossy and told him, "Clossy, the gluttony," Paddy described a meal you could only dream about: pig's head with potatoes and cabbage and mustard, no end of lemonade to wash it down, followed by ice cream and biscuits and tea with loads of milk and sugar, and if you like, you could